And welcome to the pre-recorded interview with John Mundy. This is Amy Toy for Angel Answers Magazine show, and we're going to be doing an author that I really love. He's a great guy. His name is John Mundy. He authored Living A Course in Miracles, an essential guide to the classic text. And according to Amazon.com, after A Course in Miracles and Marianne Williamson's A Return to Love, the best-selling book based on the teaching of A Course in Miracles, John's right up there. So how are you doing this morning, John? Thank you for doing the show. How are you doing?
Absolutely wonderful. It's nice to be talking to Amy.
Yes, and I appreciate you coming on. You've authored other books besides Living A Course in Miracles,
right,
an essential guide to the classic text. You have authored Listening to Your Inner Guide. You've done The 10 Laws of Happiness, Awakening Your Own Calling. John, how did you, how did the course come to be for our listeners? How, because some people don't know about the course or they have heard of it but don't really know what it's about. What is the course exactly in your own observations?
Sure. Well, A Course in Miracles, it's a book. Actually, there's three books. There's a textbook of 669 pages. Mm-hmm. There's a workbook with 365 lessons. You do one a day. It takes a minimum of a year to get through the course. There's only one rule in the entire course, and that is don't try to do more than one lesson a day. You can go slower than one lesson a day, but don't go faster than one lesson a day. And there's a manual for teachers of 62 pages. So all total, we're looking at just about 500,000 words, which constitutes the course.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 1965 with Dr. Helen Schuchman, who was a research psychologist, professor at Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York City, happened in conjunction with her boss, whose name was Dr. William Thetford, who was head of the Department of Psychology at Columbia. So we're talking about a very prestigious organization. Mm-hmm. It started really in 1965 when one day Bill, who was head of the department, turned on Helen, his assistant, and said to her, there's got to be another way, meaning there had to be some way that us human beings can get along with each other without all this fighting and backbiting and game-playing and one-upmanship that really characterizes every hospital and every university and every college and every police department and every fire department and every pharmacy and every family in the world. And very characteristic of herself, and I know it was very uncharacteristic because I knew Helen, spent the last 5 years of her life working with her, Helen turned back to Bill and said, you're right, I'll help you find it. And that was, in some sense, the first miracle. The first miracle was that Helen agreed to help somebody. Helen can be kind of contrary. On the other hand, you know, when I worked with her, she was on her helping side. And when she was on her helping side, she was really, really wonderful in terms of her being able to take certain people under their wings and kind of, you know, under her wing and kind of bring them along, and she was great at that. In any event, a little bit about Helen's background. She grew up in a family where her father was half Jewish, half Lutheran, preferred to think of himself as a militant atheist, which is interesting because if you're militant, you've got some kind of relationship going on with God.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother looked into theosophy and unity and religious science, and Christian science more than anything, but never adopted any religious persuasion. Helen thought of herself as an atheist. There's no doubt about the fact that she was a genius intellectually. But strangely enough, she was an atheist who also was very subject to visionary kind of dreams, and sometimes these visionary dreams would be when she was awake, you know, not in bed, but, you know, just sitting. And one day she was writing down one of her visions. This was after the experience that had happened with Bill. And in the process of just writing, there came the line, this is A Course in Miracles, please take notes. And she did for the next 7 years, and it massed itself up into those books that I just mentioned a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was published on June 22, 1976, passed the million mark in sales in 1992, It's currently about 2.2 or 3 million in sales. It now exists in more than 20 different languages and has very slowly and very subtly over the course of the past 35 years or so had really a profound influence upon an awful lot of people. It's really being regarded as a modern spiritual classic.
Yeah, I agree with that. I came to the course in 2008 when Marianne Williamson, who I adore too, she did Oprah and Friends, she did her radio show, and she did a workbook lesson that year, and that's how I came to know the course. But I never read the text until I read your book, so it was interesting.
Well.
That's how I came about it. I did the workbook lessons first, which you're right, 365 lessons, one a day. It's like a vitamin. You take it one a day and keep the ego away, I guess. I don't know how to put that. But, you know, the text, though, is interesting because there's different terminology in the text. What, how did you come to the course, and what moved you to write this book that you've, you know, about the classic text? How did you come about that?
Well, I met Helen and Bill in 73. They came to a lecture that I was giving for a conference through Spiritual Frontiers Fellowship in Chicago. After the course was finished, or even before it was finished, Helen and Bill began to look into things which had come in a similar way to the course, like inspired material that was given to the author, like the Edgar Cayce material or the Seth material.
Okay.
And this conference was on that kind of stuff. And they came to a lecture that I was giving on mysticism, which was really my area of expertise over the course of the years. And I was introduced to the two of them at someone's home that evening at the end of that day. And I remember when they introduced me, they said something about the fact that Helen had written like this inspirational book. I don't think they said A Course in Miracles. And I must admit that I was kind of a cocky 30-year-old PhD student at the time and probably thought I knew something. I think if I had known who was sitting there listening to me, I would just, it was good that I didn't.
Yeah. Yes, ignorance is bliss, right?
Yeah, right. So I actually remember looking at Helen and thinking, isn't that sweet, the little old lady wrote an inspirational book. You know, like, it probably has some nice prayers in it. Well, it does. It has some very nice prayers in it. But anyhow, that's how we met. And then the next year, 74, I wrote a letter which was published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology expressing interest in being in contact with anybody, excuse me, who was working in the fields of psychotherapy and spirituality and where those two fields crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill saw my letter and told Helen he thought it was a call for her to complete the writing of the psychotherapy pamphlet. So after the course was done, there were two more pamphlets that came from the same source of the course. One is called Psychotherapy, Purpose, Process, and Practice. Well, Helen had begun that. She'd written down 13 pages but had never finished it. So, of course, Bill and Ken Wapnick were after her to complete it. So she agreed that my letter was a call for her to complete the pamphlet. She completed it in April 75. She called me and said, I have something for you. I did not know what she was talking about, but I agreed to go meet her and Bill and Ken in Ken's little tiny studio apartment in New York City. It was the most Spartan thing you've ever seen. And Helen sat on Ken's daybed and told me about the course and how it came into existence, how it had influenced the people who were there in the room, and gave me the manuscript of the psychotherapy pamphlet. And I remember walking home that night carrying the manuscript under my arm, thinking that probably the most important thing which had ever happened to me had just happened, but I had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good year and a half before I really began to understand what the course was saying.
Yeah, because the course to me is, like I said, I'm just reading the text, and I think everybody comes to the course in their own way.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
At their own time. I mean, I've been in possession of the course, the combined volume, with all the, you know, the text and the workbook and the manual and all that stuff for about, I think, 5 years. And I didn't pick it up until, you know, I started doing the workbook. It was always calling to me. So there's some basic terms in the course that people, you know, aren't familiar with. And, you know, I know that the course talks about the insanity. What does that mean? We're insane. You know, the atonement. You know, those different, you know, if you want to explain a little bit about that, what those different terms are.
Okay, well, insanity, first of all, course, distinguishes between the world of God or and then our world, which is sort of the world of the ego. One is wholly real, God's world. You can equate God's world with heaven, eternity, truth, reality, etc. And then there's this world, which is broken off from that. And actually, the whole Adam and Eve story is a very good mythological, dreamlike, but nevertheless great way of understanding how this split occurred, where Adam thought that he could think a thought outside of the mind of God, which is really the thing which then gave rise to this whole world and every aspect of it, which is really, in terms of the Course, a dream. It's impossible to be separate from God. But just for a moment, you, I, mankind, we, Adam, thought this thought, and for the last, depending on how you want to view historical time, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands or millions of whatever years, several billion of us have been trying to think the same thought, which is namely to think that you could think a thought outside of the mind of God. You can't do it, but trying to think that thought is really the thing that gives rise to the insanity of the world. The insanity is that we are broken off, and actually in terms of the Course, it means that we've fallen into an illusion. Mm-hmm. Reality would be heaven. See, we get it kind of backwards in this world, and by that I mean we tend to think of what we call reality. Heaven seems like a fantasy. It's the other way around. Heaven's reality. This is the fantasy. This is the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we just start dreaming the dream, and we start making up. When you sleep at night, when anyone sleeps at night, they project a dream. They are the creators of the dream. And usually there's very frustrating. I had a dream early this morning that I had forgotten to go give a lecture somewhere. And I was very, I remember waking, you know, as I'm waking up, you know, you wake up and you kind of panic, oh my God, I forgot, let's go give this lecture, I forgot. And then, you know, I wake up and I think, oh, there never was a lecture you were supposed to give. You never missed a lecture. That was a dream.
Exactly.
And how often do that's the kind of dreams we have, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what it means by the insanity of the world. But then the insanity of the world is all of this affirmations that we make about what we call reality. If there is ever an ox that was a moron, it's got to be reality TV. I mean, you turn, you know, I walk into the family room one evening and my daughter's watching. These girls are in their 20s screaming at each other on television and actually pulling each other's hair, and what they were, every few words had to be bleeped, and it was just a kind of bleep, and I said, honey, what are you watching? And she says, it's reality TV.
Wow.
This is actually insanity. This is insanity TV. This is not reality TV.
No, it's not.
That's what it means by insanity. That's insanity.
Yeah. Yes, it is. I mean, we have a lot of that.
The insanity is the thinking that that is real.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
You know, it's almost sad because we do, you know, we do have this illusion, and you know, we buy into the illusion, you know, with the. You know, especially with the government, you know, with the presidential election coming up, you know, all this stuff, and I'm thinking to myself, this is an illusion, this is an illusion. My fiancé's
right,
like,
right.
What are you talking about? Honey, study
well,
the Course.
Well, it's a play, you know, it's an ongoing,
yeah.
The whole, whatever game it is we're playing, you could be playing a church game or a president of the local Mason game, I don't know, whatever, pick a game, you know, play the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's all game. Most of it's pretty harmless, but sometimes, of course, if it's an aggressive game, then I'm better than you are kind of game, we start getting ourselves in trouble.
Yes. And where does the ego come in? What is the ego?
Well, the ego is actually a misperception. There's actually two things the Course says you can't define. Both are two little three-letter words. The first thing that we can't define is God. And the reason we can't define God is because God is just way beyond words don't work. I mean, words are symbols of symbols that are twice removed from reality. So how in the world you can't put into words a description of something which defies words? And it's one of the definitions that actually every one of the world's religions has for God is that God is love. And that's true. But what is love? You know, it says on the first page of A Course in Miracles that love is an experience, but then we can add that it's an experience that transcends definition. You can't. I remember when I first fell in love with my high school sweetheart, I remember looking at her and saying, I love you a lot. I love you very much. That's so inadequate. You know, it just doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I'd write poetry, and that'd be better, but it still wouldn't do it. You know, it's still, because it's an experience, and it's an experience that defies description. So you can't really define God, but we know God. We know, for example, we know there's something called love. Everybody will attest to the reality of it, but it's invisible, it has no form, you know, and it also has no definition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other word we can't define is ego. And the reason we can't define ego is because in truth or in reality, there is no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
It actually doesn't exist. It's a part of the illusion or it's a part of a dream. But it looks very much as though it does exist. And so my favorite definition of ego, because we need a working definition so that we know what we're talking about, even though we're talking about something that doesn't exist, an illusion. Mm-hmm. So my favorite definition is that the ego is that which defines.
Mm-hmm.
Interprets, projects, judges, analyzes, compares. You know, it's the thing that's always doing good and bad and nice and not nice and pretty and ugly, you know, which draws all the distinctions. It's the thing which does think that it can think a thought outside of the mind of God, which, again, we said is impossible, but that's what it is. It's I once asked Ken Wapnick, who's really the major spokesman for the Course, what he thought, why the Course came when it did. Why did it come during the latter quarter of the 20th century? He said he didn't know the answer to that for sure, but there was one thing he was sure of. It couldn't have come until after Freud, because it wasn't until Freud that we had a real clear ego psychology. I mean, Freud understood the ego very well. It's no accident, by the way, that Helen understood Freud very well. You know, and therefore, you know, if you think about the things which have come to us, Mozart said he did not write his sonatas. They were given to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that Mozart knew how to write music, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you ever heard of a fellow named Ramanujan who lived from 1880 to, I think it was 1918, a very short life, only got into his 30s. But he was from India. He was an Indian mathematician, which came about 3,900 theorems, almost none of which have ever been proven false. And he said that they were given to him. He didn't create them. But he knew mathematics, in fact, because he was sort of an idiot savant in that he could only think in math, which is just phenomenal, you know. And he was brought to Oxford University, and they were going to make him a fellow at Oxford, but he couldn't pass courses in history and sociology. Because he could only think in math, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Helen, who knew Freud. Here's Mozart, who knew music. Here's Ramanujan, who knew mathematics. And it might be somebody else, who poets very often, will say that the poetry was given. They didn't create this. It was just like this given to them, you know. So, anyhow, that's kind of how this whole process works.
Now, you mentioned about projection. What is projection? You have a phrase, perception and projection. Your perception.
Yes. Three words. It's the first three words of Chapter 21 of the Course. The sentence appears twice in the Course. Actually, the way that goes, it says, projection makes perception. The world you see is what you make it. Nothing. nothing more than that. Mm-hmm. While it's not more than that, it's not less. Therefore, to you it's important. It is a witness to your state of mind. It's an outside picture of an inner condition. As a man thinketh, so does he perceive. That line, interestingly enough, is from Proverbs. Jesus quotes it in the Gospels, and then it shows up a third time in the Course in Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next line from the Course is probably one of the most quoted lines in the entire Course, which is, therefore, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world.
Mm-hmm.
Choosing to change your mind about the world means that we wind up loving the world instead of projecting onto it, blaming it, analyzing it. There's a line in the Course which says the ego analyzes, the Holy Spirit accepts. And we kind of analyze the hell out of everything, good, bad, and nice, and not nice, and pretty, and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that gets us into trouble. Because
mm-hmm.
then we say that somebody is bad or something, and that yeah. they need to be fixed, and we know how to fix them, right? And then we've got a war.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the most difficult thing is, what's that scripture that says something about Jesus says you can see the faults of the rafter in your brother, but about what about the rafter in your own eye or something like that?
Yeah, why are you so concerned about a speck that's in a brother's eye when there's a beam blocking your own vision?
Exactly, yes.
And then the next line is very important, and it's very in keeping with the Course, and that would be, first, remove the beam from your own eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next line is a very interesting one. And then you will see clearly how to take a speck out of somebody else's eye.
Hmm.
And the way you take the speck out of somebody else's eye isn't by doing anything. It's actually by your correct seeing. And your correct seeing is that you're seeing the truth. You're seeing the innocence. You're seeing the wholeness that's
mm-hmm.
in there, that's in everyone, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And you're loving them. And in that process of seeing that wholeness, that innocence, and loving them, that's the thing that transforms
mm-hmm.
you, and by transforming you, it transforms the world.
Interesting. Yes. And what is the Holy Spirit? How can we, who is the Holy, or what is the Holy Spirit, and how can we use the Holy Spirit to help ourselves? Or how's, according to the Course?
The Holy Spirit is really a symbol
mm-hmm.
for, the Course says, for the voice of God. It's kind of the intermediary between God and ourselves. It's the communication link between ourselves and God. It's the way that God kind of gets through to us. You
mm-hmm.
shouldn't take it literally in the sense of thinking there's some body that is a
mm-hmm.
Holy Spirit. It's
mm-hmm.
really symbolic, but it's, you know, we kind of need this symbolic intermediary between ourselves
mm-hmm.
and God
mm-hmm.
who can communicate the right. We are constantly, according to the Course, we are constantly being given the right information that we need to live our lives the most natural, perfect way that we possibly can. And there's a wonderful, wonderful analogy for it, which comes from the 21st century. And
mm-hmm.
it's something that everybody can understand because more and more people have GPS systems in their cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the GPS system works, I think it's one of, they've got a little black box. You take this little black box, you punch in your intended destination, and within seconds, that little black box makes contact with four gold and silver angelic beings flying around this planet at 17,000 miles per hour each. One gets your longitude, one gets your latitude, one gets your altitude, and I think one gets your attitude. And then they have a little conference. At the speed of light, literally the speed of light, they send back to you exactly the information you need to get from where you are to where you want. Let's say there's a button on all GPS systems called home.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever you are in the world, if you hit home within seconds, that thing will tell you exactly left, right, by foot what you need to go to get to go home. 49 from the workbook in A Course in Miracles says God's voice speaks to me all through the day. And that's true. We're constantly being broadcast. We're constantly being given the right information. Now, you could call the Holy Spirit that mechanism by which we are being given the right information, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, do we pay attention to it? Mm-hmm. Or the Course says the basic problem we all have, the most basic problem we all have, is the authority problem.
Mm-hmm.
So the authority problem is we're all kind of recalcitrant children. But the main problem we have with children is the authority problem. Whose will rule?
Mm-hmm.
When our daughter was young, when she was a teenager, if her will had ruled, we would have eaten pizza every night. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now she's an adult. She eats pizza every night. Her mother and I have something else, right? But that's kind of what we do. We say to God, you know, I'm going to do it my own way. We're all kind of like prodigal sons and daughters. We're all kind of these recalcitrant children. We're going to go out, and then we try to make our own world. We create our own world. That creating of our own world is the creation of an illusion. It's creation of a fantasy. And it's the fantasy, which of course we also call a dream, what it calls the dreaming of the world. So we dream this dream, we dream this fantasy about. I was watching a show the other night on television on prisoners who were doing a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interviewing different ones of them. I noticed that each one of them had created a persona for themselves, I guess, mm-hmm. to kind of help them deal with this. They all had nicknames like Doc and Tiger and Big Lynn and et cetera, and they wore tattoos. But more important was that they had developed a kind of a defensive attitude about things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but that's really no different than creating. We do it in what we call the real world as well. It's not the real world. We call it, you know, so you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a reverend, or you're a lieutenant, you're a captain. There are no doctors, there are no reverends, no lieutenants, there's no, none of that stuff we make up all that stuff. None of that exists in heaven. You know?
Mm-hmm.
There's no division in heaven, there's no separation, there's no segregation. Right.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So it's the same kind of an idea. But so the Holy Spirit then is this communication link. And what the Course is saying, if you just pay attention to me, if you just, what we all want to do more than anything else is we want to do God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the Course, that gives us our greatest happiness, because that is actually the thing which is the most natural. And when we're the most natural, principle number 5 from the 50 Miracles principle says miracles are natural. When they don't occur, something has gone wrong. So much of the time, something seems to have gone wrong. And that's because we're fighting, we're attacking, we're complaining, we're mm-hmm. looking for problems. And that creates the mess in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's an insane world again.
Right, right. What is a miracle?
A miracle is a change of mind by which we begin to see the truth of the reality of who we really are, as opposed to being caught in the illusion of the world and the story and the drama and the soap opera, you know, the way we've been making it up. So it's an awakening to true, what the Course calls true perception, with, you know, seeing things correctly, as
mm-hmm.
opposed to seeing the way we're projecting it, the way we're making it up. And again,
mm-hmm.
miracles are just perfectly natural. Health is natural, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, as the Course says, you have no idea how many miracles occur on an ongoing basis that
mm-hmm.
you never see, because there would be no. We only see the phantasmagorical kinds
mm-hmm.
of things that we think of as miracles, but health is a natural miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Love is a natural miracle, miraculous
mm-hmm.
state, for example.
How can we stop that chatter in our head? You know, we're trying to live by the Course. How can we stop the chatter? I love your story about this, by the way.
Oh, you mean the Stop It? The from,
yeah,
the,
that's
from the,
yeah. I love that. That's a great story. That's actually,
well, it is wonderful, and any listener could check this out for themselves, just by going online. The first way to stop it is just to realize that you're doing it, and to realize that you're crazy. I was talking to somebody once, and she was just going on and on and on and on about something, and she just suddenly stopped what she was saying, and she looked at me, and she says, "I'm being projective, aren't I?" I said, "Yeah." So the first step is that you got to catch it. You mean you got to see that you are insane, that you're crazy, and then once you see that you're crazy, then you have a chance to stop it, go the other way. So the Stop It story that you're thinking about, which is fun to tell, is when Bob Newhart played a psychiatrist on television back in, I guess it was the 1980s, there's a wonderful clip that anybody can watch on YouTube. It's about 6 minutes long, where the opening scene is that Bob Newhart is washing his hands in a little side room next to his office. And that's an actually important part of the story. Then he comes out, and a new client comes in, and they introduce themselves. They have politeness. And then he tells her, he says, that's going to be $5 in advance, please. She says, $5? And why? Why $5 in advance? He says, well, I charge $1 a minute. This was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only going to last 5 minutes. In fact, it's not even going to last 5 minutes, but I don't get back change. So that'll be $5 in advance. She says, well, okay, here's $5. And he says, what's your problem? And she says, well, I have this fear of being buried alive in a box. And he says, well, stop it. Just stop it. She says, what? She says, I said, stop it. She says, you have to stop thinking about it. Yeah. Stop thinking about that. And she says, yeah, but, I shouldn't we talk about my parents? And no, don't go there. It's not about that. Just stop that. And she says, well, I have another problem. And he says, well, what's that? She says, well, I think I'm probably bulimic. You see, I take my fingers and I put them down. Stop that! you're hurting yourself. My God, don't do that! And it continues like this for two or three different things that she brings up. And I think the last line, before the last line, at one point, she says, well, I wash my hands a lot. Mm. And he says, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Because he is a hand-washing obsession himself. A lot of germs out there, you know.
Yeah.
And the last line of the whole thing is, he said, stop it, or I'll bury you alive in a box. But it's actually that simple. I mean, it really is that simple. I mean, everybody knows. I'm giving a talk this coming Sunday in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the title of which is Everybody Already Knows. Everybody already knows the truth. Everybody already knows that this is true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just a matter of choice. I wrote an article, it's coming in the next book that I'm writing, called Who Pulls the Puppet Strings, which is about, you know, who's making these choices? Who's lighting that cigarette? Who's pouring that? Who's opening that tab on the can of beer? Who's making these choices?
Mm-hmm.
You've got to see who's making the choices. What the course is about, in a lot of ways, it's about being responsible. It's about being totally, absolutely responsible for everything that comes your way. And because then you can't complain about what's going on. And being responsible is what leads to happiness. The more responsible you are, the more you do what God is asking you to do, the happier you are.
Mm-hmm.
The more you run away, the more you don't look, the more you deny, the more you hide, the unhappier you are.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. That is very,
very
true.
Simple.
It's very simple, and I think we as humans overcomplicate everything. We really do.
Oh,
you
the
know,
course
the first...
says, at one point, it says that this is a very simple course. It says so several times. And then at one point, it says simplicity is very difficult for twisted minds.
Yeah, I saw that quote last night when I was looking over my notes.
So it's not that the course isn't simple. We're not simple. We're, you know, we twist everything around. We make it really complicated. And it's not really complicated. Doing God's will is the most natural thing in the world. So the question is, why don't we do it?
Right. Are we? And the course does bring peace of mind, and that's, well, I mean, Foundation for Inner Peace, you know, publishes the course. So,
right.
What is your advice to people who are, you know, going into the course, and how should, is there any set rule to start the course, or you just pick it up and wherever it leads you, or?
Yeah, you just start. You know, it's like the other time we were saying stop it. Well, in this case, we'll say do it.
Just do it, right? Like Nike, just do it.
Just do it. You know, just pick it up. Just start it.
Yeah.
You know, stop it, start it.
Yeah, really.
Of course, they can always get my book as an assist, you know, but there's nothing like, you got to have the course itself, but there's a lot of books out there that are guides, and mine's just one of the more recent ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually got your book sent to me, This Wasn't God's Will. I belong to a book club, and they sent this to me because I didn't say no to the feature selection, and they said, oh, The Course in Miracles. I started reading it, and then a friend of mine said you were coming to the Unity Church in Buffalo here, and I was like, I got to have him on my show. So it was it was meant to be.
Good. Yes, it was.
Yes, it was really.
Everything was meant to be when you see it the right way. And mm-hmm. when you look backward through the spectrum of your life, you'll see it more and more. That it had to be that way.
Because I'm writing my memoirs right now, and I'm definitely seeing just the pattern of my life. I don't do it in consequential order, but, you know, Spirit will put in my mind, okay, write about this part of your life. And
that's right.
You know, it's like, wow, if I didn't know that, I wouldn't be able to help people with this. And I really feel that the Course, I love the Course in Miracles, like I said, and I've been really diving into it lately. And what about the concept of time? Is it, you know, the Course talks about that's a learning tool. Is that correct?
The time is a learning tool, and the other thing which is a learning tool, which is really, really important, and neither one of these things exist, even though they both look like they very much exist. The body is a learning tool. That's what the Course says. It's a learning device. And you are not a body, and the Course makes a I don't know any document which is so clear in its emphasis upon the fact you are not a body. The body is a very temporal experience. It just lasts for a moment in time. So Shakespeare's got it right when he says, out, out, brief candle. Life's a poor player that struts and frets its hour upon the stage. A tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury. And that full of sound and fury is the insanity. It's the insanity of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning,
definitely.
And it doesn't mean anything. It's like a dream. It's like any dream that anybody has ever any night that really doesn't mean anything because it's just a dream. It's just a fantasy. Think about this for a moment. Psychologists tell us that we have about 8 dream cycles per night per person, right? There are 7 billion people on the planet. So that means that last night, there were 56 billion dream cycles that people went through. And nobody is going to remember anything about any of those. Maybe 0.00000001%, you know, gets remembered and kind of, but even that fleeting and goes away pretty quickly unless you write it down. So, but they're all fantasies. And yet, at the time that they're happening, they seem very real. They seem like they really are going on. And that's what the Course is saying. It's that it seems like this, it says your nighttime dream, your daytime dream, has a different form. And that's all. So we're still dreaming. We're still dreaming when we're awake. And part of the dream is that it's occurring in time. Time is also an illusion because time is where the dream occurs. There's a past in a dream, But all past is really a fantasy, you know, and the further we get, doesn't your childhood seem kind of like a dream at this point that happened once upon a time?
Yes, it
does.
In
a land far, far away, there was this girl named Amy, and she had these kind of experiences, right? But you know, that's all fleeting, and the future is just a projection. You know, it's on your... subheading on the book that I'm working on now is a line from the Course in Miracles, which says, God's will for you is perfect happiness now.
Mm.
And the word is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have perfect happiness in the past.
Right. No.
It's gone.
No.
And
yeah.
And fantasizing it about in the future, well, that's not, you know, that's right. Eckhart Tolle's book, The Power of Now, you know, was on the bestseller list for about 3 years, few years ago, for a very good reason, because he hit on something that was really real. People identified; they could say, "Wow, that's right. That's the way it is. You know, it's only now." The Course says, "Now is as close to heaven as you can get, right now."
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get there in the past. And it's not. The Course says, "Heaven is here." There's no place else. Heaven is now. There's no other time.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a section in your book about what if, fear, and the future, you know, and that's true, because what if this happens, what if that happens, and we're not really looking at the present moment. And I think that's our, you know, I get caught up with that, too, and I tell myself, stop it. I actually think
right.
that.
Good. Keep telling yourself that. You know, you keep telling yourself that until you actually do it.
Mm-hmm. And and you stop it, and you're like, whoa, what am I doing here? But, you know, as I study the Course more and more, the more I'm becoming aware of my thoughts, and I never...
That's the whole thing.
That is the whole key there, and it is, it's a very important tool, you know, too, to learn your thoughts. And what's it saying in the Course, something about where do thoughts originate?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that's really the question. No questions. But you can actually get caught into a kind of infinite regression about that. But you want to really look at that and think, who is the projector?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a chapter in the new book I'm working on now that's called Who Wants to Know? Which is really based upon a couple of experiences I had. But it's really looking at who's asking that question. Who wants to know? Who's trying to figure this out? So, but if you can get to that perspective, then you get what the Course calls above the battlefield. You get a higher perspective, and you look back, and you can kind of begin to see what's going on. You can see that you are the projector. You can see that you are making it up. And once you see that you're making it up, you can change it. You can let go of your angry projective insanity, for example.
Yeah, and there's one chapter that I really resonated with was healing the terrorist, and you have error, in quotes, within, on anger and responsibility. Now, I supposedly have an anger issue, but when I read the Course, it's like, it's really not.
No.
It's really, it's my perception of it, so.
It has to be,
right. So, what you talk about taking responsibility to, John. How can people do that? I mean, taking responsibility for some people I've observed is very difficult. It's like the no-no, at least from people.
And yet it's the only way you're going to be happy. You know, it's the only way that you can get out of what kind of misery that you're in. For example, the Course has a lot to say about forgiveness. As you know, forgiveness is sort of a key feature of the Course. I was doing a workshop once, and I was talking about forgiveness, and there was a young woman in the workshop who said that there was just no way that she could forgive this SOB former boyfriend of hers for having jilted her. And you could see that it was making her really unhappy that he had run off and left her. And I said, well, and she said, what can I do? And I said, well, one of the things you might recognize is someday you will let this go. So seeing how someday you will let this go, then why not do it right now? Because the sooner you do it, the happier you're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable. You will let it go. And and very few times does this actually happen. Most of the time, the whole process of the course is sort of a slow and gentle process. But you could just sort of see she got it. I mean, she just kind of got it right there on the spot, that she was just going to let this go. There was no, it was not doing her any good. It was all in her head. Where is the unforgiveness? It's in her head. It's not someplace else. It's not out there. That's where guilt is, too. You know, where is guilt? Where does guilt exist? Guilt exists inside your mind. Not in somebody else's mind. It's not out in the world. It's just in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So the healing of that guilt, the healing of that unforgiveness, is a very simple decision that you make. And it's the decision is that you're going to let this go. You just really let it go. You're not going to let this affect you. You're not going to let this drag you down. And you can do it. And once you've done it, you're free. You're liberated. You're no longer weighed down by this. That's accepting responsibility. Rather than continuing to project that he's an SOB and da-da-da-da and telling everybody about it. Somebody called me up once, and she was going on about her husband had been unfaithful to her. And she was calling up all of her friends and just telling all of her friends about it. And I said, look, one of the first things I'm really suggesting you do, please stop talking to people about this. Stop calling your friends and complaining to them about it. It's not making you feel better. It's not making him feel good. It's not making your friends feel good. So just stop it. Stop that.
Right.
And yeah, and she kind of got that too. I think it with time, it took her a little bit more longer than it did the girl in the workshop. But after a few days or weeks, she gave up that kind of projective stuff that she was doing.
Yeah, because it's really not any doing you any good if you keep talking about it, bringing it up. You're still keeping that.
Oh, it's actually a way of holding on to it. Of making it real. You're making it real by amplifying it. The idea is to let it go, not to amplify it.
Exactly. I actually have a neighbor too. She, after 34 years of marriage, and she'll bring this up. This guy, her husband, was unfaithful to her, which he was throughout their marriage, and she had lung cancer, and he left her after she was diagnosed with lung cancer. And she's very resentful.
Sure.
Yeah. I was reading your book, and I said, you know, it's like you taking poison for him by you bringing this up. And she kind of looked at me. Like, okay, where are you coming off with this stuff? But, you know, you can see in her face, it's just every time she brings it up, it's so much pain. You know, so I let it go and let her do her thing. But, you know, that's really sad. But also, you have to let it go, because sometimes we can have that poison in our system. And you've experienced that, right, John? You had cancer.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. And having cancer was a wonderful experience, because it gave me an opportunity to take a really, really close good look at death, because it was cancer which spread, and the diagnosis wasn't good. And I really accepted the fact that I might die, and then I realized that I was going to live for at least a few more days or weeks or months. And, you know, so what did I have to do in the time that I had left? And I had to be just the most loving person I could to in each encounter that I encountered. And, well, anyhow, about a year after that diagnosis, I was pronounced cancer-free. Of course, I went through chemotherapy. I did the traditional stuff as well. But it worked.
It does work. I've had cancer twice, and I did the holistic and the whole, you know, the conventional. And it did work both times, thank God.
Yeah, right.
But you do look at your life, and I've also had two near-death experiences, and people, after my second one, too, death doesn't look the same. You're not afraid of it. It's like, okay.
No, there's nothing to be afraid of.
No, and people don't realize that, and you talk about the one chapter in the book that I really love was talking about being kind. It was like the kindness, you know, when people die and they do the eulogy, and you talk, you know, because you officiate over the eulogy. People that want to do eulogies or whatever, you know, talk about how the person was kind, not about how many, you know, houses they owned or how much money they had in the bank or how many friends they had. It was about the kindness. And that's true. We want to leave the, you know, this earth being kind. And that's very important. But I feel that your book was very inspirational. I understood the text. I try to read the text once a day. You know, just take a section and read it.
Yeah, that's really good. Digest it.
And any final thoughts before we go? Now, you tell people where they can find you. You have a wonderful magazine called Miracles Magazine.
Right.
Which I do get a copy of, which is awesome.
Good. Well, the website is called miraclesmagazine.org, and you can go look around there. We will send you a free sample copy of the magazine to anybody who requests a free sample copy. It has whatever CDs I've done on there and whatever books I've written listed there as well, which can be ordered as well if one wants to buy a book or a CD, and has a list of different places where we're doing lectures, so if it's anywhere near where you are, you could possibly come and attend a lecture. You know, I guess my best parting thought would be that it works. I mean, this process really, there's nothing that says anybody has to do the course. It's one of the things I love about the course. The course says of itself that it's a way, it's not the way. It just says there's thousands. It says it's one of many thousands of the different pathways back to God again. And it's not like one pathway is better than another pathway. They're all, I think we need to pick a pathway which is suited best to our temperament. So by that, I mean, for some people, they like a kind of bhakti yoga, heart-centered approach that, you know, they can kind of fall in love with God. And others need a kind of more of a jnana yoga, intellectual understanding pathway to work through things. And so there's all these different possibilities. The course is sort of a combination, I think, of all of these. I mean, it's not deliberately so, but it's a heart-centered, but also head-centered at the same time, and also body-centered, not body-centered in the sense of saying you are a body, but in the sense of helping you to heal your body, helping you to understand how to treat it so that it can be a good learning instrument. The idea is to keep it functioning well so that it doesn't become a burden to you, and therefore you need to spend all your unhappiness trying to deal with this thing. So the main thing is that it works, and there's lots of groups. You can go online to find, there's a place called Miracles Distribution Center in California, which keeps a list of all the study groups around the country, and you just type in your where you live, and it will tell you what are the nearest groups there are to where you are. And, of course, there we list on our website all the conferences that are going on around the world. There's actually, we just got to, I wrote an ad just for the first European conference that's coming up in May of next year, and there's one in Chicago and in April, and so it goes.
Wow, that's great. Yes. Yes, I'm very lucky. I have two Course in Miracle groups in my area, which I found out about. Yeah, so it's a wonderful book. Well, John, I really appreciate you coming on.
Sure, Amy.
It was great. Thank you so much. I will send
you
a copy of this if you like. So, all right. Well,
good.
You have a blessed day. Thank you
so
much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
You too.